Hi, this is Bonnie Gillespie, and you're tuned in to The Work.
It's Verona Blue, everybody. Welcome to The Work.
Thanks. I'm excited.
I'm excited to have you, sweetheart. Yeah, as we always start on this podcast, how did you and I first connect, or what was the beginning of your SMFA journey, if you recall?
Okay, so several years ago, my friend Justice, I'm from Toronto originally, and my friend Justice came to visit, and we had been previously in an acting class together in Toronto. She has the best name on the planet. It's Justice Dara, which is just unfair.
That's hot.
But she came to visit, and I had been here in LA for about maybe 6 months. And I was still finding my groove as far as, like, I didn't really know anything about the industry here and how it worked, because I'd come over from London. And I hadn't really made any efforts to move forward that much. And she had come and planned on auditing a bunch of acting classes, and she was staying with me. And she said, why don't you come? And so we were talking a lot about classes in LA and how they differ from, you know, where I went to theater school in England versus the classes we took together in Toronto. And she mentioned you, and she showed me a bunch of your articles, and they immediately resonated with me. And I find it actually really interesting when I've watched some of the other episodes of The Work, where you talk to other actors, like particularly Kate really stood out, where she like didn't get it. And it is so weird to me, because a lot of the things you talk about seem to me like a lot of common sense, and they're just reframed for the context of acting, and particularly how acting in film and television works in Los Angeles specifically. And like, I don't, as you know, and I'm sure other people will very quickly learn, I don't buy into the whole woo-woo thing,
right?
But all the very pragmatic elements of self-management for actors, there were a lot of things I already used in my life in other bits of industry, but I just needed to figure out how to take what I kind of already inherently knew in business and like apply it to people that I didn't really know how they work. And all the things I knew about how they work was like what media tells you about Hollywood. And like, that's so not at all how it really is. So I started reading your articles, and then I think I Googled you to see like if you existed on the internet in any other capacity. And then I found the class, and I told Justice that I'd found the class, and like, I signed up for like the next available one.
I'll never forget that moment in, I want to say it was week three of the class. We started doing a lot of the content creation and incorporating conversation. And I remember looking over at you and just going, holy shit, she's going to do all of this.
Yeah,
because
I did.
I could see the light bulb. Like you just were cracked open on that one. And I went, oh, that's sexy. That's really cool.
Yeah. And I did. I think I had filed my incorporation paperwork by the time the class was finished.
Yeah. Yeah. You can't, like, I remember coming out after one of the classes and you were doing a joint venture agreement with somebody else. And I was just like, this girl's all over it.
Yeah.
It was really exciting.
Yeah. It was great. And there have been lots of things that I've learned that are new, but just so much of the lessons and the way you approach acting as a business entity rather than just like you're an artist, which is what they tell you at theater school. Especially if you go to conservatory school, you know, they cast you as like the leads in everything. You're always amazing. It was very hard probably to get into that school in the first place. So you already feel like you're ahead of the crowd, because maybe my school took 12 people per class. So you're one of 12 people that got in over hundreds, maybe thousands of people who auditioned. So you already feel like you're top of the world. And when you're in school, they always make it out like you're so amazing and you will go far because you have such a strong base. And then you get to LA and they're like, we don't give a shit where you went to school. How much do you weigh? Are you under 25? What color are your eyes? And you're like, but wait. And I had to figure out how to talk to those people and like convince them that like this was going to work her ass off for them.
So let's go back a little to your beginnings, even, you know, before conservatory training. What made you decide a creative career was your path?
My earliest memory is watching television when I was about five and like seeing some other little girl on TV that kind of looked like me. And like, I remember going to the kitchen and telling my mother that, like, I wanted to be that girl and, like, we needed to work that out. And she was like, no. And my parents are very supportive of the arts. Like, they, in a very bougie way, like, they go to the opera and they go to ballet and they go to the symphony and they go to the Shakespeare Festival. Like, they have season tickets for everything. And even when they winter in Florida, they go to, like, whatever is playing down there and then complain about how terrible it is. And so I was put in music lessons very early. I'm a classical flautist, which people are very surprised to find out. It's not cool. Jethro Tull does not count. There's no cool application. So don't try to convince me it's cool. It's not cool, but I'm very good at it.
It's interesting. It may not be cool, but it's damn
interesting. Right, right. It's beautiful. It's just not cool. And so I was sort of indoctrinated into appreciating the arts very early. And I went to classical music concerts and things like that very early, and to the theater very early. But I think the sort of catalyst moment for me was I went to go see, I'm going to say it was like, I could look this on the internet, but I think it was like 1990, maybe 1992. I went to go see a version of Amadeus at the Shakespeare Festival in Ontario. And Salieri was played by an actor called, of course I'm going to forget because somebody's asking me the question. He recently died. Anyway, he was amazing to the point where the guy who played Amadeus was fine. But the guy who played Salieri, like, I, at the end, was, like, sobbing as, like, a young person and could not, and, like, I realized this relationship that actors have with the audience when they're really connected to it and, like, when they tell the story really well in a way that I'd never experienced. And so that was the thing that I was, like, this is what I need to do. And I'd always kind of been like a showy offy kid to begin with. Like, all of the pictures of me in middle school, like the plays, like all the kids are just kind of standing there. And I'm like, you know, at the front of the stage, like really proud to be doing whatever we're doing. So after that, I just did like a lot of musical theater camp and like went to young people's theater and took classes in Toronto and did all of those things.
So there was never a question. This was always
no. There was. It's interesting though. There was never a question. And then when I was in high school, I went to a private school, and it was very focused on academics. And everybody, you know, in my school, like, and they all go to Ivy League. It's a very like math science based school, and they do have arts, but it's like not the priority. And I kept asking my parents to send me to performing arts school. And they just never wanted to. And then finally, when I was about 16, they said, if you really want to go, you can go. And I was like, well, now it's just going to look like I couldn't hack the private school and dropped out. And I was like, now it's just going to look like I failed out of that. So I'm not going to, like, I have 2 years left. That's dumb. So I didn't. But I did submit to audition for Juilliard and was granted an audition, but did not go to my audition.
What?
My parents basically said they booked me my ticket to New York and everything. And like, I had a place to stay, but they basically said like, even if you get in, we're not sending you.
Oh,
so, and I was like, oh, and like, that was the day that I stopped acting for like a long time.
Like, I didn't know that.
Yeah. It like broke my heart to the point where like, I gave it up completely. And I went to school for film, but it was like, I took a drama class. The teacher never showed up. So like, I think we had three classes out of the whole term. And then like the class was like, the teacher was just never there. Professor was never there. But like, I went to school for film and new media for my undergrad, but like, I completely stopped acting. I was a model for a long time. I was like an event promoter and I DJed and I did like sort of a lot of performance, but I completely, completely gave up acting. And then a couple years later, I was dating an actor who'd won an Emmy, and I was friends with a couple other actors who were like quite successful, and I kind of couldn't get away from it. And I was really jealous. Like, I could feel it. Like, I was just, I mean, my disconnect from performing was so strong that like, I couldn't watch movies like Fame or anything like that because it really upset me. Cause I just felt like I was like, that is never gonna be my life. And I can't, I would cry about it. Like, I couldn't deal with it. But then all of a sudden I was like around all these actors, and like, because I was dating this guy, I would like go to set with him sometimes. And he was like, your eyes are green. And I was like, oh, I know. So I like couldn't. So I decided I was going to start taking some acting classes locally again, which I did. And I just went like to a fundamentals class, nothing. I didn't try anything fancy, started fundamentals and moved my way up. And I also decided to audition for Shakespeare Summer School in London at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art. And I got in and I did that. And I was like, if I can hack this, because it's like 7 a.m. to question marks every day, you know, in rehearsal, if I still love this, then I know. But if I'm like, this is like, I'm exhausted, because I've been living basically as an adult, right? I've had jobs, I've been out of school, like I was living by myself, I ran my own schedule. Being a student is totally different, especially when it's such a long day. So I went to RADA and I like fucking loved it. And literally the day I got home from London, I started growing my dumb hair out, like all my shavy. And I started growing out my mohawk and I started auditioning for theater schools in England.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah.
And how long did you live in England before you decided to make the move stateside?
3 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then was the game plan always going to be Los Angeles, or did that sort of evolve?
Well, that was always my game plan, but the problem is I'm Canadian, right? So
right.
It's not so easy. It seems like, 'cause we're almost the same, but like, I can't just move here. So there are lots of visas and things. By happy coincidence for me, I met a nice American boy when I was living in London and we got married. And so I got a green card. Woo-hoo! So he solved all my LA problems, much to his chagrin, because he does not love it here. But when I was 16 years old, I came here on a trip and I was like, I remember being in Hollywood and looking around and driving around and being like, this is the place that I have to end up. And I didn't know how I was going to get there or why, but I knew that inevitably, like, I was going to fight my way into LA, and I've been here for 5.5 years. Oh, I love it.
It's a great city for you. And but were there gear changes? Because, you know, especially coming from the Shakespeare program and all the time that you spent in London and having had the growing up in Toronto of it all, what of it did you find jarring, if anything?
London, by the time I left London, I was super ready to go. London is prohibitively expensive, even if you have a good job. I mean, my husband was working at Google, you know, and I was working at this tech company like full time. And, you know, when I wasn't acting, and we had a great salary, we had a very nice flat in like a good neighborhood. And it was just expensive. Like, we did not have a car. I rode a bike everywhere because I was tired of being sick all the time. Every time I would take the tube, I would just be sick. And you can't, it's like New York. It's so populated that you never get time by yourself. Like, you're never, never alone unless you live alone. 'Cause you get up in the morning, you get on the tube, you go to work or wherever, and then you come home and there's just people everywhere constantly. So I started riding a bicycle 'cause I was going crazy. And so, you know, there were a lot of factors that sort of really turned me off on living in London that, my husband looks through rose colored glasses, I think, when he thinks about it, but it's still very visceral for me. Wow. And I will go back to visit, and I will never discourage anyone from visiting or going to school there, but like, don't go there for 10 days and be like, I could live here, because you'll kill yourself. It's like, it's not an easy place to live. So coming to LA was like quite a relief in a way.
I was felt like coming home then.
Yeah. The weather, is spectacular. I had a car again, which was just nice. Not that I love traffic, but like, when you are taking transit every single day for 3 years with, you know, it's just nice to have a car again.
You love your cars. You're like me. Like, that's your baby.
I do. And customer service is not really a thing in England. Even bare bones. Like, I know we all hate Comcast, but at least like through gritted teeth, they will like read their pleasant script. And in England, you call and you're like, hey, my internet's out. They're like, okay. And you're like, ugh. So a lot of creature comforts and stuff like that. It was like coming home. Canada is not so different. We do have running water and television. So it was just like Canada, but warmer. There are things about living in the US that are like not relevant to this, I guess, podcast, that bother me. A lot of like racism and classism, especially in LA, a lot of segregation in LA that I never experienced living in Toronto. And I certainly, in London as well, London is like super multicultural as well, and not segregated, at least where I lived, in the same way as I really feel very strongly about Los Angeles. So there, I mean, it's not perfect, but it's great.
I want to talk about the part of that that does overlap with the topic of this podcast and our beautiful industry, because, you know, I know that that's something you're really passionate about, is seeing stories get told from a more inclusive perspective. What challenges, because you mentioned earlier, are you under 25? What do you weigh? What color are your eyes? I mean, what sort of barriers have you found that our industry, unfortunately, doesn't move fast enough to conquer?
Well, obviously, women in general, whether they're in front of the camera, behind the camera, they are drastically underrepresented as writers, as directors, as leads in films. And that's something that really bothers me, because we make up a huge amount of the population. And although there's something to be said for having characters written from different perspectives, like, I don't necessarily think it's always the best approach to just take a script and be like, all right, well, I'll just make this character a woman and this character black and this character South Asian and we're done, because then a white guy wrote it, because we have our own perspective of the world. And I think you end up with a lot of situations where if you have white dudes writing diversity scripts, it's very tropey, you know? And like, I was having a conversation with a friend the other day who's an actor, and he's from Hawaii, he's black as well. And he was telling me, he's like, literally every movie I've ever done, like, my character starts every sentence with "yo." And he was like,
ow,
he was like, fucking kill me. He's like, I have a more diverse, he's like, I'm not even like a homeboy. Like, he's like a martial artist and super zen and like world-class, like fighting, you know, like cool, like zenny Hawaii dude. And it's just endlessly yo, yo, yo for him. And so there's something to be said for having people who actually write the characters have a different perspective on the world than somebody who is a white guy or even a white woman. So, you know, my own barriers, I'm a woman. It kind of stops there, because the rest of it is self-imposed. And I'm very aware of that. Like, my dumb hair and all my tattoos and all the shit in my face, like, these are choices that I've been able to make for myself. And they are helpful in some respects and not helpful in others. But I try to be very conscious of the fact that, like, as a white person, I have an automatic advantage, and to not take that for granted, and to like actively encourage my friends who are writers, who do work in production, who have any kind of authority, to like think outside like the obvious. I think I was talking to Ann Woods about her screenplay, which she told you about recently, about The Cult. And we were talking about it, and you know, she's supposed to play the lead, and she's like, so obviously the parents have to be white. I was like, no, they don't.
Right.
I was like, it could be your step. You could be a stepmom. Like, is it important to the story how your family was put together? She's like, no. I'm like, so why can't your stepmom be black or Asian or Pakistani? Mm-hmm. And she was like, you're right. I was like, your parents don't have to have, if it's not relevant to the story of like why your family is this way. Oh, barking. Goodness. No.
Oh boy. We got a fan club starting up.
Midge, stop. Then just change your characters. So that's something that I end up a diversity cast technically in a lot of cases, because I add a different perspective and like visual real estate to a production because of my dumb hair and my tattoos. And like, that's good for me, I guess, but it like sucks for like actual diverse people of color.
Well, and then how often are there roles that are written in the breakdowns really describing you? Because I know so much of what actors do when they're self-managing and targeting is they scour the breakdowns and which one is me, which one is me. I mean, how often are you described in a breakdown?
More often than you would think, to be perfectly honest. However, there is a caveat to that. Most networks get terrified of me in real life. Which is funny, because I do talk with casting directors who I can see their frustration. And I went through this very recently with a gig that I just booked where, I mean, they fought for me and I booked it. But like, there are breakdowns, and my agents are like, this is all you, because they'll be described like specifically as goth or like lots of piercings. Like, we want your true alternative types. And I go in and I can act and I can take direction and I do a good audition. And then like network or somebody higher up just gets freaked out. It's too much for them. They are not, you know, it's this weird catch 22 that they don't actually believe that I'm an actor sometimes. Because most people who look like me who work in film are not technically actors, like do a lot of background work, but they don't necessarily have any training.
Right.
Because actors are told not to do this, right? You have to be flexible and like, don't box yourself in, which kind of obviously goes against everything that you teach us. But we're told to kind of stay as neutral as possible and then let, you know, production build the costume or whatever on you. And so often I'll go in because it's what they asked for. And then they're just, they'll see it, but they will put me through so many more rounds of audition or like testing to like convince themselves that I'm what I say I am. Even if the casting director is like, yes, she's like, I'm looking at her resume. I've seen her reel. So it can be tough. Because there have been things that I was perfect for and then I got put on hold for and then didn't book. And the person that they booked was like nothing like the breakdown and they weren't necessarily amazing.
It's so interesting to me that you're having to have these folks really sell the no, she is in fact an actor because, you know, you've auditioned for me and you are one of the finest auditioners I have ever experienced. I just think your craft is phenomenal and you're just so well connected with your instrument and the work that you do. It's unquestionable. So the fact that there's any kind of no, trust us about it just seems bizarre because the proof is right there. Your work is unquestionable.
They get freaked out. And in some contexts, I understand. Like, I do appreciate that for your average person, this can be a lot. And especially if you put me next to your lead in particularly a television show, more so than a film, I really steal the focus.
Sure.
Because I'm like a very bright and very interesting to look at.
There's so much to take in. It's like, right. I'd study what is that and what's that.
Right. So like, I understand that in some cases, like the character's not supposed to be that big, right? Yeah. So they're going a different direction or they're toning it down because they feel like it pulls too much focus off their lead. But, you know, more often than not, it's these characters that are like recurring that really do need to pull focus because they do move the story along that it will come down to me and one other person. And then like at like the last minute, like I won't get it. And they go a totally different direction. And there's one, I'm not going to say which one it is because it's just shitty, but there was one in particular that like, I was so heartbroken about it. The character was described as unapproachable. Like unapproachable is very specific. And it was like tattoos and piercings and things. So like I wore a shirt that said motherfucker on it.
Yeah.
Like unfucking approachable. And then I went to producers and there was like 12 people in the room and like the EP was in the room and the showrunner was in the room. It was like a pretty intense, like nerve-wracking thing. And I was charming as fuck when I walked in, so they weren't actually afraid of me.
Good, good.
I made like jokes about, because I was wearing a bullet belt and I made a joke about it because they were like, that's cool. And I was like, yeah, well, it really fucking hurts when you have to drive in it and because it like spikes in you. And I was very charming and like they were laughing. And then I did the scene and everybody was super rapt. And I was like, that is in the fucking bag. And like I emailed my acting coach who coached me on it. I emailed my agent. I was like, no question. And my agents called me. They're like, yeah, you're amazing. They're going to call tomorrow with an offer. And then they never fucking called. And they booked a very beautiful brunette with no tattoos and no piercings. And they gave her like a fake rose on her chest and put her in like short shorts and like a boob shirt, which is not what I would consider unfucking approachable.
Yeah.
And the character got cut from like 5 episodes to 1. And if you watch the show, which again, I'm not going to say what it is, but if you watch the show, like, the character vanishes and it doesn't make any sense. And clearly to me, what happened is they were like, this doesn't work.
It's not authentic.
Because the whole point of this character on the show was that she and the lead in this particular love relationship were both really broken. And that's why they related to each other. And now she was like, just great. And he was super fucked up. And so them moving through space together didn't make sense anymore. So she was just cut. And like she went from like a recurring to like a one day guest star for this actress, unfortunately for her. But like it really broke my heart and I couldn't figure it out for a really long time. And then I recently went through a similar thing with the same network, but I got the part this time and now I put 2 and 2 together.
What was the difference?
This time specifically, both the showrunner and the casting director like fought the network. They like fought. They called my agent first. Do the Pierce, any of the Pearsons come out? Can you, if you take them out, is it like, do you see holes? No. Hey, do you have a really updated reel that we can show? Yes, here you go. And then they were like, you're the one to beat. There's just, we have a couple of holdouts is what they said. And then casting was like, I will bring her back in and I will record more versions of this so you can see that she takes direction. Yep. And so when I went back in, I took all my piercings out of my face. I wore my hair up instead of down because it's like more, it's less aggressive. And I wore this green shirt that I have that makes me look very friendly. I don't know, green, I don't know, my complexion. I look very TV approachable.
Yeah.
So I was like really toned the fuck down as far as I can go. And I just looked way like I'm a nicer person. And we did it. She worked with me for like 45 minutes and we just kept doing it. She was like, I want you to get this job. Cause I kept being like, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. She was like, I want you to get this job.
Yeah.
Like I want you and the showrunner wants you. And like, we're both pissed off that the network is being difficult. So we're going to make sure that you get this job. And I was like, okay.
And it's phenomenal once you have people at that level who are willing to fight network and who have enough clout that they can, because I'm sure there are other showrunners, other casting directors that wouldn't be able to push back against network.
Yeah.
And so that I think is part of the game that you're tracking now and able to see, ah, okay, there it is. And you know how to play it.
Yeah. Cause I like, obviously as my log line is, I'm surprisingly nice and casting directors generally like me. And for the most part, they think I'm talented. You know, and like you like me, but the thing you always say about me is that I'm the most talented person you can't cast.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very frustrating.
And so like, I know there's probably a lot of other casting directors who are like, she's really good, but like, I can't put her in this. And I have like one casting director who works for ABC Freeform. She fucking loves me. ABC Freeform loves me, brings me in all the time. Can't fucking cast me in shit.
Well, it's one of the things that I've always said, you're going to skip the place where you go to the co-star and the one liner, and then you go up to the two liners and then maybe it's, you know, shooting a page. You are entering way higher because the role has to be so very specific.
Yeah.
And draw that kind of attention. And, yeah, you know, so it's just a different way of managing the whole.
Yeah, I mean, my first co-star was like 4 pages.
That's incredible.
With William H. Macy.
Yeah.
Like that was my first network co-star.
Not bad.
Yeah. So I did, and I did go from like a couple of co-stars and now I'm recurring. And I just skipped guest star completely. Not that I auditioned for them. I just didn't book them. And then I just booked this like recurring. So awesome. Good for me.
Yes, indeed. Talk about some of, I know you've got a pretty ridiculously cool credit. You've got a few very cool credits, but you got one in particular that I want to chat about if you're open to it.
Totally. And I know where this is going.
Okay. All right. So go ahead. Take us on the journey of how this all happened.
So last year was kind of slow for me. I had a couple of auditions, but overall, like it wasn't super busy for auditions. And I got a far in a couple and then they just didn't work out. And I just felt like I was never going to book shit ever again. And then this one director that I'd worked with on the show previously, like booked me on like a sci-fi feature for Sci-Fi Channel. And he was super cool. And I was like, okay, well, at least I did something this year, like did something. And then I got a call, a text message actually, asking me to come and do looping, which is voice stuff in a group for Star Wars The Force Awakens. And I went in and did what's called a loop group, which is when you do all the background voices, all the crowd scenes, the yelling, the screaming, the chatter, whatever, to create atmosphere in a film. And in that, there's a lot because there's all the cantinas and there's the like bases and all that stuff. And that was an amazing day. It was a full day with like 20 actors total. And like a lot of them are very accomplished voice actors, like super accomplished voice actors. I had an amazing time. And then about 2 weeks later, I got a text message again from the people who work at Skywalker Sound saying, hey, do you want to do more voice work? And I was like, yeah, totally. For what? And they said, we need a female stormtrooper. And I was like outside at this adoption fair. So I worked for a dog rescue. And I just started going and like jumping up and down. And my friends are like, what's happening? I was like, I just booked a thing. I can't tell you what it is.
Of course you can't talk about it. Right.
I couldn't say shit to anybody. So So I went to go, I went in and I actually did like 6 pages of dialogue from The Force Awakens for different characters. And in the film, I mean, for me, the most important one is the female stormtrooper, because it's the first ever female stormtrooper. It's like a white, just regular stormtrooper. And I talked to Kylo Ren and like, they did not modulate my voice. Like when I watch it, it's very jarring because it's just my voice. It doesn't have like a weird filter on it. It's just me talking. And I'm like, oh God, that's what I sound like. And then I also do, all of the resistance based PA announcements. So like when, they come back from all the runs and stuff and they're on the bay and you hear all the PA system being like, all the pilots, please proceed to the flight deck. Like that's all me. And then I do a bunch of officers on Starkiller as well. So my voice is like peppered all over that movie, but that stormtrooper, man, I got a stormtrooper tattooed on my elbow. Like,
yeah, you do.
That's like the fucking coolest thing I have ever done. And I'm a huge Star Wars fan, and I got to be a stormtrooper. Holy shit.
Dream come true.
Dream come true.
That is phenomenal. I love it. So when were you allowed to talk about it ultimately? Not till it came out? Or?
Yeah. Like, so I'm a huge Star Wars fan. I lined up for Star Wars for 2 weeks at the Chinese Theater with all the crazy people who camp out. Like I totally camped out overnight.
And you would have done that either way.
Yeah, no, I would have done that other way. And like, because I did it for episodes 1, 2, and 3 as well in Toronto. And I was going to do it anyway. So like I was in the line and I'd already seen huge chunks of the film because you have to see it to do the looping. So I didn't know the whole plot, but I'd seen a lot of like very important shit. And I couldn't say anything. And couldn't tell anybody. So like in the Star Wars line, you have like a badge and you have like a red, blue, green system for like red is like no spoilers. Green is like, I'll talk about whatever you want. And blue is like only officially released stuff. So you don't like ruin anything for people.
Oh, cool.
And so, but like, I was like, I can't say anything. And it like literally was until the day that like we went into the theater. I was like to all these people that I knew, I was like, just so you know, I'm in the fucking movie. And like, I tweeted and like posted on my Facebook and like nobody, like my husband knew and like my brother knew. And like one or two other people I told like really privately, but like I just couldn't. Disney NDAs are terrifying.
And you got to take those NDAs very, very seriously.
Yeah. And when, you know, they invited all the people who did looping to come back to do Rogue One in episode 8. So I don't want to fuck that up for myself by being like, I'm in Star Wars. This is what happens super early.
Yeah. But how, as an actor, do you use the momentum of such a high profile booking when it's not even something that your agent can, I mean, like I've had agents pitch to me and say things like, I can't say what, but she just booked something really big. I mean, are they able to use it somewhat, or is it just,
I don't really know. Like I told my agents, because like I got it independently of my agents, because I'm represented across the board, but I wasn't technically represented for voiceover at the time. There had been a transition in the voiceover department. And when I had applied for voiceover, because I knew the assistant, they had been like a thanks, no thanks. And I was like, well, that's weird, but okay. I mean, fair enough. I mean, you guys already have me commercially and theatrically. It's fine. Yeah. And so I booked out to let them know I wasn't available. And I told them why. And so at that point, when I went to go and renew my contract, I was like, hey, I see voiceover is here now. It wasn't before. Like, is that like, is this a mistake or is this intentional? Like, I want to just be on the same page as you guys. They're like, no, that we've changed how the voiceover department works and we totally want you for voiceover. So I didn't really start going out more for voiceover until after the film was out. Yeah. But then I started going out for super high profile shit, which I've booked none of, incidentally, but nonetheless, like Voltron, the new Voltron I auditioned for, and like a ton of like really big things. And I just go in and the lady who did the looping casting for Star Wars has called me in for things specifically. I listened to those auditions and they were great. So I don't know who they actually, like, they must've just cast Sigourney Weaver, like casting me, because those auditions were awesome. But it's more competitive than on camera.
Oh, for sure.
You're competing against like the whole world because it's not location based.
So how do you stay balanced, especially, you know, as you're talking very matter-of-factly about going into, you know, bigger and bigger shit and having these rooms and these experiences, these auditions, and then go, and I didn't, you know, incidentally, I didn't book any of it. How do you stay so centered? And I know you're not woo-woo, but how do you stay balanced with all the what some people would call rejection? You know, I don't label that as rejection, because sure. rejection is I rip up your headshot and break your demo and say you're not allowed to pursue acting.
Yeah,
that's rejection. But you're a part of the selection process, and when you're ultimately not cast, how do you shake that off or deal with it?
I have tempered my expectations, I believe, quite extensively. One, because I'm aware of how I look, and I'm very conscious of the fact that I exist on the fringes of castability, particularly for mainstream production. Yes, a lot of things are getting edgier, Orange is the New Black and all of those kinds of things. But realistically, you know, if you watch television, there is nobody who looks like this regularly on television. There's a lot of men who can fill this role of like heavily tattooed and kind of alternative and whatever. But this, like, I hate to say it, but like this like Suicide Girl character does not exist at all regularly. I'm hoping I will become that person that they're like, call the one with the blue. But we just don't exist. Like this kind of tropey, she doesn't exist. So I've tempered my expectations realistically, I think, in that way, to be aware that there's not going to be as many opportunities for me as there might be for somebody who's more mainstream. And that like, it's kind of a miracle that I get into a network audition to begin with.
And it's a miracle anybody does.
Right. Right. No, true enough. But that on top of it, like the fact that there's how many tens of thousands of actors in LA, and if they're calling in a lot of people for a network audition, like a co-star or like a guest star or something, maybe they're calling in, let's be generous to say they're calling in 30 people, they chose 30 people and I'm one of them and I look like this. Mm-hmm. So like that to me is like, I'm making progress because I'm meeting that person. Like I love auditioning. Mm-hmm. I love going into a room and being funny and charming and having the opportunity to work on real stuff that's actually being produced and showing them that I can do this. Right. And even if I don't book it, I know that it's a long game. When I get into a scenario like with that thing where it was like, we're going to call and make an offer tomorrow and then they don't, like that sat with me for a long time. Like that was something I couldn't shake for quite a while.
Because the expectation was there that it is going in this direction and on this timeline. And then
oh God, somebody's at my door. Sorry. Stop.
We knew it might happen.
Yeah, we knew it might happen. Stop. Thanks, FedEx. What did you say?
No, I was just saying, because with that in particular, you had an expectation of it
going
a certain way and on a certain timeline. And I think that adds to the stress of it.
Sure. So like that did sit with me for a long time. It made me feel bad. It just like really hurt my feelings more than anything. Cause I was like, I don't understand how I got so far and like what, and I do tell myself, like, I know it's a business decision. Like, I know ultimately if you get a callback at all, great. If you get put on hold, like you've booked the job for all intents and purposes, you've booked the job. So like from a, if you're looking at yourself internally and trying to reflect on like the work that you're doing, if they put a pin on you, you've booked the job. Even if you don't make a day on set, you've booked the job. Great. And everything else is a business decision. So I try to be very realistic about that and just pragmatic about the fact that it is a business and it's not personal. And it's just a matter of time for that person, like I had recently, who's going to be like, no, you are the one we're going to put on the show and like we're going to fight for it. In addition, like I, you know, on a good year, I film, I'm on set, what, like 30 days a year, maybe so far, which is like not very much. So like I have a whole other life that I live every single day that is not focused on whether or not people like me enough to put me on their show. And I spend my time watching a shit ton of television. So I know what's going on. And I know what the current, I know who's writing. I know who's casting. I know who like won an award for casting for what, like I know who's a new showrunner, like what person that's probably roughly my age that like somehow mm-hmm. finagled their own show and like who are our mutual friends on Facebook. And I was like, oh, that's weird. We are already friends on Facebook. Like, and just kind of just being aware of the things that are happening, but I like to be an actor because I like telling stories and I fucking love television. I know a lot of people think it's like brain garbage, whatever. Great. Good for you. If you don't like it, I don't fucking care.
Right.
I love television. I've always loved television. I will watch television for 12 hours straight and not even notice and like get wrapped. I'm one of those people who like, even if the red herring is obvious, like I do not sit there and try to figure it out. I like let it wash over me and I let the surprises happen, even if they're obvious. I just like to live in the moment with it. So I participate in the film industry at different levels, like as a consumer as well as someone who wants to participate. And then like my day to day, I take ballet now like 4 times a week, which I just started doing this year. It's super hard physically and mentally, and I love it. I'm on the board of directors of a dog rescue. So I'm like actively involved in my community doing something that I love and helping, I think. Mm-hmm. LA and animals and engaging with people in a way that's beneficial to not myself. Like, I think it's really important to participate in your own life in a way where you don't expect anything in return. I don't think that you can be balanced in that sense. If any time you do anything, you're waiting for some kind of reward or like favor back. I think it's very important to like, If you were in a position of privilege where you can, and not everybody can, but if you were in a position where you have the time or the resources or whatever it is to like give back to people, then you do. And whatever that is, whether that's a skill set that you have, like, I work as a web developer during the day and I do free websites for registered not-for-profit dog rescues, totally free, like no strings attached, because that's my skill set. So when I have the time, I like do that for them. So I try to like participate in my life in a way that doesn't revolve always around acting, yeah. I guess. And that helps a lot. And I travel a lot. I have friends who are afraid to leave LA. Yeah. And that guy that I dated when I was getting back into acting, he never wanted to go anywhere because he was like, if I leave, I'm going to miss an opportunity. And I was like, but like, you haven't done anything in 8 months. Like, it's not going to happen next week. And if they want you that bad, they'll wait for you. I was in Africa. And my agents knew I was there, but they emailed me about an audition. And I was like, I'm in Africa.
Right.
I can't tape an audition. I will be back in 10 days. And I was like, I'm really sorry, but I'm like, I can't, there's nothing I can do. And they were like, okay. And then they emailed casting, and casting's like, she can send it a tape when we get back. When she gets back, we're casting a lot of roles.
They'll work it out.
We'll work it out. Yeah. If they really want you to see you, they'll work it out. So, and if you miss that one thing, like realistically, that wasn't going to be, you weren't going to get it anyway.
Right. Yeah, and live your life, because that being out there and connecting with the world is hopefully something that makes you a better storyteller.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's kind of what I do.
So, Verona, how can people stay plugged in with you or keep up with you? Social media, website?
Yeah, so all of my actory bullshit is at veronablue.com. I was going to put this on a post-it and like pull it from the camera, but then I forgot. but I don't have a blog there or anything. You can find me on Twitter at Bathory with an I, B-A-T-H-O-R-I, which is my username on this as well if it shows up in the tape. Also Instagram, same thing, Bathory with an I. If you're a Snapchatter, Snapchat Verona Blue. It's mostly me Snapchatting while I drive in my convertible with music, and I'm kind of like telling a sort of postmodern story, I think, now, accidentally with the music that I play and the landscape when I drive around. I don't know. It's kind of interesting. And then I have a fan page on Facebook. And coming up, I have a bunch of things. I'm working on a digital series, which is digital as well as VR, like 360 VR.
Very cool.
Called Vane. And it's about a group of very attractive vampires who live in Los Angeles called the Mulholland Coven, and how they've shaped culture. And it's like very sexy, very bloody. The trailer for the prologue, which we shot all in 360. So it's like, if you have a Vive or anything like that, it's this like crazy fight scene and bloody and hot. Like everybody in it is ridiculously good looking. Mm-hmm. It's absurd. And that trailer should be out, I believe, in later this month, I think. It's always hashtag Vane or Vane360, Vane as in vanity, on Instagram. Maggie Levin is the writer director for that. And then I had a movie that I did last year called Drone Wars for Sci-Fi Channel that is now, I'm actually doing ADR tomorrow. So post, I guess, is almost done. It was supposed to be out in March and it's not. So September, they didn't give me a date. They'll tell me tomorrow. What else am I doing? I feel like I had another thing. Oh yeah. And then, I'll be on season 3 of Bosch on Amazon, starting next year. And I think that's it right now.
That's quite a lot.
Hopefully Rogue One, you'll hear my annoying voice some more.
Nothing annoying about it.
And I signed, I don't know if anybody cares. I signed a whole bunch of Topps cards for Star Wars collectible, limited edition, whatever. And they will be out soon. So
see, now that's cool. When you're a trading card, that's damn cool.
Yeah, they send me these like 500 holographic stickers to sign my name, and then they stick them on a sticker in like a Star Wars pack. It's pretty cool.
That's actually a very neat perk of the job right there.
Yeah.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
Verona Blue, you're wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing this time with me.
Thank you for having me. That was super fun.
All right, my friends, this has been Bonnie Gillespie for another episode of The Work. Thank you so much for joining me here. Please join me over at BonnieGillespie.com for all sorts of goodness between episodes. And until next time, stay ninja.